consistently has a direct application to your life. And so I'm praying and hoping that you'll see that from this really, really cool section of Scripture. So we just sent a team to Costa Rica on a mission trip. And one of their primary responsibilities when they were there is partnering with ministries in Costa Rica that are helping and serving refugees. See, right next to Costa Rica is a country called Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is not the safest country in the whole world. And many of their people are fleeing Nicaragua to come to a country that they feel safe and they can grow a family and they can prosper. And so they go to Costa Rica. That is why if you would consider going to Costa Rica, it is an awesome mission trip if you've never been on one. Because when you're in Costa Rica, you'll meet tons of Americans that are there on vacation. And so it's just a really cool place. And so you get this experience on this mission trip where you're in a country that feels safe. And simultaneously, you're getting to minister to some people that are coming from a context that is not safe at all. And so these refugees that are fleeing Nicaragua are doing it because they believe that
it's a place of refuge. They believe in Costa Rica they can find safety, security, and a future. See, a refuge is wherever you run to because you believe it can protect you, sustain you, or give you hope when life becomes uncertain. And many times, these people that are fleeing Nicaragua, I mean, Audrey told a story. She texted me and said, hey, just so you know, we're going to start financially supporting a family here. And we normally talk about that, but she was just like, no, you don't understand what happened. She said she was in a house of a family, and the mother said, you're not going to believe it. Like, you're going to think I'm lying, but we have, like, no food, like, none. And the mom's like, come with me to the fridge. She opens the fridge. There's no food in the fridge. She opens the freezer. There's ice packs, like the freezer packs. And then she opened her cabinets. There was no food. And so Audrey was like, we're going to send some money to them and try to take care of them really quick. And so this is the life of a refugee. Like, they just need help. They need guidance. There are stories of many of these people. Their husbands would go work a blue-collar job, like on a construction site in the sun. And when they get done, the people that own that construction site don't pay them. Because they literally are like, you're a refugee. What are you going to do about it? You have no value. You have nothing that you can do to stop me from treating you as such. And so many people that grow up in this context, they need help. They need somebody to hide in and protect them. And here's the truth that we're going to see from this text today. That every single one of us in this room, in a spiritual sense, is a refugee. Now, you may not like that label as an American, and it might feel kind of ick, but you are. You and I are always looking to something to help bear the weight of your fears, your needs, and your future. And many of us in this room, we find refuge in money, or we find it in relationships, or we think if I can just be successful, if you know we can get the right politician selected, if we can just get comfort, if we can just have more control, then I can finally have peace. And you and I are always chasing after that. And Psalm 62 is going to help us because it's going to answer a really simple question is, where do you actually take refuge? And the whole point, if I could summarize this chapter in one sentence, it would be this. We need Christ alone to experience true joy and peace
and satisfaction. Now, it's a longer psalm, so I'm going to read the parts that really highlight how awesome God is, and then we're going to come back and we'll fill in the gaps as we go forward. So verses 1 and 2, and then I'm going to jump to 5 through 8. Here's what 1 and 2 says. To the choir master, according to Jeduthun, I butcher that, but just say it with confidence, a psalm of David. You think going to seminary, I know how to say it, but there we go. Verse 1. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation. My fortress I shall not be greatly shaken. Go down to verse 5. For God alone, my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is front
of him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress, I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, and my mighty rock and my refuge is God. So trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your hearts before him. God is a refuge for us. So the first thing that I want you guys to see that God alone is a refuge. And before you can recognize that truth, you and I have to come to the realization that we need refuge. And the only way to really do that is to understand the impact of sin. Because if you go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, that's when sin entered the world, in Genesis chapter 3.
When Adam and Eve failed, sin affected everything. To put it simply, the world itself is broken. We live in a world where there's disease and sadness and grief. And it broke us. We are sinners. So that's why when you turn on the news, you see war and violence, injustices and abuse. When you walk through a hospital, you see people with disease and people are dying. When you sit long enough with friends and loved ones, you get to hear stories of broken marriages, prodigal children, anxiety, depression, loneliness, and grief. That is why David is saying, God is my rock. He's my fortress. Because what he's saying is, everything around me has these times that it feels painful and chaotic and crummy. And I find shelter in God himself from that broken world. So there's an element that what the psalmist is saying is, you and I, if you're a Christian, this, you are never exempt from pain and suffering. And any preacher that's telling you that's a liar and has never read the Bible. What this text is teaching is that assuming you are going to experience pain and suffering because of the brokenness around us, we have somewhere we can run. We have a place that we can settle and endure the pain. And so not only is the world broken, but the text is saying so are we. Like, you and I don't just occasionally do sinful things. The Bible teaches that our hearts naturally wander from God. But we pursue our own way instead of His. We love things more than we love God. And we rebel against His authority. And one of the greatest battles that you will fight in your life is against your own self. It's resisting the urges and the impulses that lead you to behaviors and actions that are destructive and bad for you. Like, that struggle is not for those bad people outside of the church. That is a struggle for every single person who is alive. Fortunately for us as Christians, we have the hope of Christ to help us combat that and fight it. And so, see, our sin can create a problem that is far bigger than just the suffering around us. Our sin creates separation from a holy God. And we need relief from that pain. We need forgiveness of sins. Because we feel guilt and we feel shame. We know what we did was wrong. And that is why David is declaring that God alone is his salvation. He's not only saying, he's kind of saying it in a dual way. He's saying that God saves me when I need help and everything around me is going crazy. But then he's saying God is actually my individual salvation. Like, the forgiveness of sins that I have, I find in him alone. And this is the beauty of the gospel. That Jesus died in our place. He died and he rose from the grave. And when he did that, he bore our sin, he paid our debt, and he offers forgiveness of sins to anybody that would trust him. And that salvation is only found in him. And so the requirement for you understanding that God is a refuge is for you to see your need for a refuge, that we need to run to him. And the text is really clear that what you find in that is him, is God. See, since the world is broken and we are broken, we have to run to something to escape all of that messiness. And the point that David is making is clear. Here's what he's saying. For David, the greatest source of joy, peace, fulfillment, and satisfaction is God himself. I'll be quick here because I don't want to give you a whole history lesson on David's life. But have you guys ever noticed that, like, somebody could say something that's true to you if you're struggling and you don't want to hear it? But if that person has gone through what you've gone through, it sounds more true, even though the sentence is the same. Do you guys know what I'm saying? It's a phenomenon of, like, lived experience. It's kind of the postmodern way of thinking. But the principle is, if somebody's walked where you walked, you're more likely to believe them. Now, here's my point. David has a lot of street cred when he says God is his refuge. David has experienced the broken world around him. David had two completely separate times in his life, one when he was younger and one when he was an older man, where he had to leave his home and flee because there was an army or a small group of people led by one guy that hated him on two separate occasions, two different men. One was a king named Saul, the other one was his own son named Absalom. And David is running for his life. And the only reason they wanted to kill David was because they didn't like him and they were jealous of him, particularly Saul. So David knows what it feels like to be betrayed,
David knows what it feels like to have your life threatened because of the circumstances around you. But David also knows what it's like to be broken on the inside, to wrestle with his sin. Next week, we're going to study Psalm 51. And David wrote that after he had been caught having an affair. And that Psalm 51 captures his heart of repentance, of him turning from that and running after God. So David knows what it's like to give in to those impulses. He literally took another man's wife and then murdered the husband of that man, that guy, in order that he could keep the wife for himself to hide the fact that she got pregnant. I'll tell you the whole story next week. My point is, he knows what it's like to fail. He knows what it's like to need God when your circumstances are bad, and he knows what it's like when you are sitting in a room and you know the mess of your life is your fault because you did something you should not have done. And in both of those cases, what David is saying, what I need is God. He is the only one that is going to get me through this. That's why he says, God alone, O my soul, I wait in silence because my hope is only from him. Maybe an analogy that kind of captures this is, I don't know if you guys have ever tried to go body surfing before. It's like my favorite thing to do at the beach. I'm not a fan of just chilling on the beach. I want to do something, and that's why I didn't necessarily love the Gulf of Mexico when I lived in Plant City. People would always go to the beach on that side, and it was prettier. Like, the sand is whiter, and the water is bluer, and it's, like, it's legit prettier. Like, you could debate it if you want. But I'm like, I want to go and swim and get wrecked by a wave. And so literally, the last beach baptism, me and my kids are outside, and we're in the water, and we're trying to body surf, and a wave hits me, and it just destroys me. You guys know what I'm talking about? You ever had that experience before? And I'm not a little guy. So if a wave is tossing and turning me like I'm in a washing machine, that's a strong wave, you know? That's a lot of force. And so the principle is if you've ever tried to be in the Atlantic and surf or boogie board or do anything like that, you are keenly aware that when the riptide is strong and the waves are strong, it does not matter how good of a swimmer you are. It don't matter if you're Michael Phelps. The ocean's going to win, and it's going to beat you. See, this is a picture of the broken world in which we live. No matter how godly you are, no matter how much scripture you know, no matter how much on varsity you believe that you are bringing to the table with your skill set, you are going to experience waves that are going to wreck you. You're going to experience difficulties and challenges that you in your own strength cannot fix. See, we have these waves of suffering, of loss, of disappointment, of temptation, and fear, and where our sin feels like it's stronger than us. And in those moments, what we believe is what David is saying here in Psalm 62, that when those waves are crashing, what we believe is God is not standing way on the shore going, hey, suck it up, dog, paddle harder. That's not what he's doing. But the idea of God being our refuge is he comes to where we are, and he's an unmovable mover, like he's an unmovable object. He sits there like a big giant rock, and he pulls us in front of us, and when all the waves are crashing around us, you are still alive. Because God is your rock. He is your refuge. He's not going to sink. He's not going to get tired. He's just going to chill there, and everything's going to go around him. This is what David is saying. And this is why David is saying, in my life, that's why I need him. Like, I'm running to that rock. If you go down to verse 11, listen to what he says towards the end of this psalm. He says, once God has spoken, twice have I heard this. So here's what David is saying. After all of these truths about God being his rock, do you see how profound this is that he says this? He's saying, God's only really told me this one time, but I'm hearing it twice. Now, here's why I say this is intriguing. If you're in this room and you're a parent, unless you're like that parent that is better than all the other parents, and your kids listen the first time, that's really good. Most kids, when you tell them to do something, it takes what? More than one time. And sometimes it takes 2-3 times. And sometimes after the third or fourth time, they still don't hear you. And sometimes it requires some discipline to help them understand that they're going to hear you when you say it. You guys understand? But sometimes you have to tell them and tell them and tell them and tell them. What David is saying here is he's like, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be the kind of person that has to hear it over and over and over and over again because I'm just so set in doing it the way that I want to do it. David's like, God said it one time, but from my perspective, I'm hearing this everywhere I go. There's nowhere that I can go that I will escape the fact that God has said he is my refuge. So what does this mean for your life, my life? Y'all, I recently ran across some research done by an aviation expert, a guy named Dr. Paul Craig. And he analyzed decades of information from the National Transportation Safety Board about accidents that happen with pilots, commercially, privately, it doesn't really matter. It was a common thread through it all. And what he discovered was pilots who have less than 100 hours of flight training are safer than pilots with 100 or 350 flight hours. So you don't know how this works. Before they kind of let the reins go and let you fly the plane, you have to display that you have enough experience, enough hours. And so you have 100 hours in the air, anything before that, they're actually safer than whenever they're released. And they say that the data shows after they've been flying for 350 hours that the decrease of accidents goes way, way low. And so what this author is saying is, he's not saying this is a statistical, like, guarantee, but he is saying it's a statistical warning that when you are an amateur pilot, you are sort of, like, not overly confident. You're saying, I'm not going to be complacent. I'm not going to take any risk. I'm going to just be very careful. And I think that there is an element of that that applies to the Christian life, at least the way that I've seen it. See, let me give you an example. When you are a really new Christian, or maybe you've ever been around somebody that's a new Christian, do you know what you never have to convince them of? That God's their refuge, especially if they became a Christian later in life. If you're sitting with somebody that was like 30 when they trusted Christ, or 18, they are keenly aware of their, like, condemnation without the goodness and the grace of Jesus. And they are naturally, at least for that season of being a new believer, know they need the Lord. You don't have to convince them of that. You don't have to, like, remind them of that. They're just like, I know where I was going without him. And if you've ever met somebody that's been walking with Jesus for, like, 30 years, and I'm talking about, like, walking with Jesus. Just because somebody's old and they say they're a Christian doesn't mean they've been walking with Jesus. I'm talking about for 35, 40 years, they're in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They've been reading their Bible. They've been praying. They've been faithful to a local church. Like, they're godly. If you've ever been around somebody like that, you know they know their dependency on the Lord. Because those godly, like, old saints, when you hang out with them, they will be talking about the Jesus all the time. You guys know what I'm talking about? Like, you can sit in their house and you can talk about Christ for 3 hours and still have things to talk about because they know they're dependent. But sometimes in the Christian life, that in-between time is the one that can be dangerous. Because there's an element in which that we can begin to look to ourselves and think we're sufficient. We can be enough. We're the ones that are godly. We do these disciplines. We serve the church. We go to church. We. And the focus of the Christian life is ourselves and what we can accomplish and what we have accomplished. And if you're not careful during this, like, in-between time in your faith, you could get to the place that you functionally in your Christian life are living in your own strength. And you can begin to think, I got this. I know what I'm doing. And one of the greatest ways that you can see that's where your heart is you're insanely judgmental of people that aren't as good as you. You know what I'm saying? You look at other people that are struggling. You look at other people that aren't where you are. And you just look at them as if they are losers. And if they could just get with the program, that everything would be better. But that kind of pride and arrogance highlights self, not Christ's likeness. Now, I'm not saying anybody's in that place. I don't know. But I do think that if that is where anybody is, they miss the entire point of Psalm 62. Psalm 62 is saying spiritual maturity means that you do not graduate from dependency on God. Spiritual maturity is growing deeper into dependence on God. See, the mature Christian is not the person who needs less of Jesus. The mature Christian is the person who has learned through years of experience how much they desperately need Jesus every single day. And the danger in the Christian life is not that we'll stop believing Jesus saves. The danger is that we will start acting like we can take care of the rest. Like, Jesus saved me, the rest is up to me, and I'm going to make sure I rock and roll this. And what David is reminding all Christians is he's reminding us that it doesn't matter if you're following Jesus for 5 days or 50 years, you need the same thing, which God alone is your rock, and that God alone is your salvation,
And God alone is your refuge. So that's where we want to be as Christians. So David does something else that's really important and really, really relevant. He shows us things that some people chase down to find hope in. And I think the first one is kind of like what we just talked about. You can look to yourself rather than looking to God. But David offers two more. He says sometimes we can look to relationships and people, and we can look to money. See, the issue is not that we don't trust Jesus. If you're here and you're a Christian, the assumption is, if you believe the gospel, you've trusted Christ alone for your salvation. But the problem for some of us is we want Jesus and we need something else to have joy, peace, and satisfaction. And we get things out of order. So the first thing he says is, don't put your hope in people. This is kind of a hot, tough one, but hear him out. If you look at verses 3 and 4, you can read it later on. But he says, if you put your hope in people, here's one guarantee of life. You ready? They will hurt you. They will disappoint you, and they will fail you. David says, my lived experience is that when I say the only way that I'll have satisfaction is when I'm surrounded by people or I have this friendship or relationship or marriage, he says, what I've discovered is they'll always hurt me. Not always, but most of the time. The way that he describes it is, he says, sometimes as a person, I just feel very fragile. The verbiage that he uses in this poetic thing is he says, I feel like a wall that is just like you could just gently touch it and I'll crumble. He says, I feel like a fence that is ready to totter. You guys ever feel that way? Well, you're just like, I'm a mess right now. And David says, if you say people are my hope, then you're going to have people that when you're in that place are not going to, in the Greek word to encourage means to build up in the New Testament. They're not going to encourage you in that godly way. They're going to discourage you. They're going to tear you down. So what David says is, don't put your hope in people. They'll hurt you. They'll abandon you. They'll disappoint you. And sometimes they won't be who they need to be. Now, he's not saying all people, every relationship is like this. Because you can have relationships with people that aren't like that. So then he offers another way that people can indirectly hurt you. If you get on to verse 9, here's what he says. He says, so if you finally have somebody in your life that's not a selfish scumbag who's wounding you all the time, like, if you have that in your life where they're not like that, then those people who are kind to you and loving to you and sacrificing for you, those people will likely die and they'll leave you alone. So if you have a relationship with somebody that's not in like wounding you in this relationally dysfunctional way, at some point with them, either you will die and leave them with grief or they will die and leave you with grief. The way that he says it is that our lives are but a vapor. They're but a breath. They're here today and they're gone tomorrow. So when you do find somebody that you love and they love you back and it's this beautiful picture of how a relationship should work, even as believers, even as Christians, at some point, that'll create a wound for you, a source of pain. And I know that this is a morbid way of saying it, but it is completely true. The only way to avoid that pain, watch this, is to never have any relationships. But that's foolishness. So if we're going to love people, we're going to run the risk of being wounded by the people that we love, indirectly or directly. So the principle that he's saying here is that is why we need to run to God. Because God's not going to die. And God's not going to ever betray you. God will always be a rock that's steadfast. Then he offers another one that I think is really relevant. He says, sometimes our hope is found in money. The way that he articulates this in verse 10 is he says that there are some people who are willing to do evil things to get money. They're willing to be thieves and steal. They're willing to extort and take advantage of the poor and the downcast and the needy. You got to ask the question, why do people do that? Why do people break into homes and steal private property or go into a store and take something that doesn't belong to them? And there's sort of a narrative in our culture that says, well, they're doing that because they just need to survive. And you're like, yeah, but that wasn't food they were trying to steal. You know what I'm saying? They're stealing other things. I don't know if you guys ever get sucked into these videos on the internet of body cam footage of police officers. They're really intriguing. And if you've ever seen the body cam footage of somebody who has been shoplifting, it'll blow your mind what police officers have to deal with on a regular basis. You guys know what I'm saying? Y'all need to pray for police officers in the world that they live in enforcing the laws. Because if they're sitting, like they literally could be sitting with somebody who has something in their bag that they stole that they caught on video. And that person will either lie and be like, wasn't me. And it's like, no, you have a shirt that's blue with an emblem and that definitely was you. Or the person will say, it's not really my fault. They're like a victim, you know, like I had to do this against my wishes. And here's the question. Why are people like that when it comes to stealing? Because they believe a lie. That if I could have that, or if I could have more of this, if I could grow in my cash flow, if I could grow in my material wealth, then finally I might have peace and joy and satisfaction. That their rock, their refuge is wealth. But then he goes on to say something to add on to the money thing. Because not everybody that's chasing after money is a criminal. Sometimes we do it in a way that is just wrong. The way that he says it, if you go down to verse 10, second part of it, he says, if riches increase, don't let your heart on them. In other words, if you're not stealing for money, you're trying to increase your wealth so that you can finally be comfortable and relaxed. There's nothing wrong with having a savings account. There's nothing wrong with retiring, okay? I have both of those things, and it's not wrong. The problem is when you are asked, where's your refuge? Like when you lay your head down at night and you have peace, and your answer to that is, well, because I finally got that savings account over that threshold that I've been wondering about. That's what he's addressing. He's saying that your hope can't be found in having the retirement at the level that you want it to be, or your debit card account in the place that makes you finally relax. So you see his point. His point is that there is a temptation for all people to find refuge and safety and security and to pursue something as if it's an unmovable rock in something that is not God himself. So I want to make an application to anybody in the room that is not currently married. Sometimes single people feel like they're left out. Well, this whole application is going to be for you. And it doesn't matter if you're 15 and you're trying to get married soon. I know that kind of sounds crazy, but I mean, I wanted to get married at a young age. And it doesn't matter if you're 35. And really, let me be very clear. If you're in this room and you are not married, there are a lot of people in every single church that are content in their singleness. That's the biblical language from 1 Corinthians 7. In other words, they don't want to get married, they don't have any plans to get married, and they're leveraging their singleness for the glory of God. And that is a righteous thing. That's a good thing. So a lot of what I'm going to say, if that is where you are in your singleness, it's all good. Use what I'm going to say to minister to your single friends, okay? But my experience is a lot of people that are not married desire to get married. So if you're not like Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, who says, be as I am as an unmarried man, and you do desire to get married, I think that there is a unique application of this text to your context. Because for a lot of people that aren't married, you may be tempted to think that your refuge is in a future marriage. So remember, a refuge is anything that you say, if only I had that, then I would finally have peace and joy, security, fulfillment that I'm longing for. So it's easy to think, if I could just get married, everything would fall into place. And I'd finally have that thing that's missing in my life. And if you're here and you're single, hear me. I want to, like, nuance is the thing that is lacking in, like, Christian conversation, okay? If that is where you are and you've had that in your heart, here's what's complicated about that inside your heart. It is a half-truth. Because if you would get married the way that God says you should get married, your life would be really great. Would it be better than it right now? I don't know if I would say that, but I would say the Bible is clear. He who finds a wife finds a good thing. Being married and having a family is a gift. It's an honor. It's a blessing. It's a great thing that anybody gets to experience. So when a single person wants to get married and they have this thought, I kind of feel like I can't be happy till that happens. It's a partial truth because they see this idea in Scripture that being married's a great thing. The problem is
the problem is that when that individual person takes a good desire, which is to get married, and they make it an ultimate desire or an ultimate hope. The issue is not that you want to be married. That's not the problem. That's not wrong. There's no issue of repentance if that's where you are. The problem resides is when you believe marriage is going to solve all of your problems. The problem is that when you read this psalm, there is not a verse in here that David is going, my mission is to get you to see that God is your rock. And let me just tell you, here's the secret of letting God be your refuge. Get a dating app. Ask AI to paint a picture of you that looks really good, that gets them, and then you find a lady or a guy on the dating app and get married. That is not what he says in this text. He doesn't say run to that. He says you find it in the Lord himself. If you're here and you're single, I thought about this a lot this week. I do not want you to hear me taking a knife and twisting it. For a lot of people, singleness feels like pain, because it is. They want something that's good. God is saying, not right now, or no. And that is an internal, really deep struggle for them. So I am in no way trying to like take some salt and rub it into that wound. But I do want you to hear how this text applies to your context, which is, Jesus is enough. And I know that sounds overly spiritual. I know it does. But that doesn't change the fact that it's true. Because what David is saying, God alone is my rock and my salvation. And what he's saying is, you can try to replace God as the rock with other things in this world, but it'll always disappoint. It'll always let you down. And it is true, a spouse can provide companionship. It can provide a family. It can provide somebody to go on vacation with. It can provide long conversations. There are married people in this room that can testify and say spouses sometimes can hurt you too. And so if we put our hope in that, then we're missing the most important thing, which is Christ. So if you're here and that is where you are, I think the implication of this text is to do what it says, which is to find your comfort and your peace in Christ alone. And when you're sitting and you're grieving and you're sad that you're not married, guess what you do? You run to the Lord. And you can bring, like, God, get this, knows that grief in your mind before you verbalize it. So there's nothing you're going to say out loud in your prayer time that God's going to go, I can't believe you were thinking that. That shocks me. Like, he already knows it. And so in the midst of that struggle, in the midst of that dynamic, we run to Christ as the source of our comfort and our peace. So James, if you guys will come back up, we're going to close out doing the Lord's Supper together. Now, I know the overarching way here at the end that I've applied it is to people who are not married, but the reality is they are no different than the vast majority of us in this room. Maybe they're longing to get married and putting their hope in that, but you've taken something else. It's not marriage for you. Maybe it is money. Maybe it is a friendship or a relationship. Maybe it's success. Maybe it's a raise at work. I don't know. There's a plethora of things that we can say, if I could just have that, I'd have joy. Y'all, there is this parable from the ministry of Jesus. I talk about it a lot, and I don't mean to be redundant, but it's just ministered to me for a long time. Where Jesus says, my kingdom is like a treasure that's buried in a field. You guys ever heard that story before, the parable? And what Jesus says is, Jesus says that when you realize how valuable that treasure is, you are willing to go sell every single thing that you own. Because whatever I got in the bank account right now is not more valuable than that treasure that's in that field. So you sell everything that you have, you buy the field, and then you're rich the rest of your life. Now, Jesus is not giving financial counsel to people to grow wealth. Jesus is talking about a spiritual truth there. And what he's saying is, would you be willing to abandon everything in your life if you could just have Jesus? Y'all, I was in this room, like, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago. One of my best friends named Bob.
He was a groomsman at my wedding. He was the best man at my little brother's wedding. I've told this story before, but it's worth mentioning again. He just died out of nowhere. Like, he was a few years younger than me. Well, it wasn't from nowhere. He was working, and he inhaled some chemicals. He wasn't have the right mask on, and they found him collapsed and dead. And in this room, we officiated his funeral. And Bob had an uncle who right here was pacing. He was an African-American pastor, and I say that to say that the way that he was communicating was just, it was just amazing to hear how he was sharing. And I'm not exaggerating you. It felt like 100 times. It's not that much. But he just walked back and forth, and all he kept saying to us is, God, you do not know that God is all that you need until God is all that you have. Over and over and over again. And I think that sort of captures what David is saying here. What David is saying here is the world we live in is broken. And there'll be moments that the loneliness and the isolation and the pain and the frustration and the shame of your own sin is just like crushing you. And when you get to that place, despair is not for us if we're Christians. When you get to that place, you realize God is all that you have, and you run to him. So that's my prayer for the Lord's Supper. So as we come today, we come to the Lord's table in different perspectives, but we always come with the same goal, which is be reminded of Christ. So maybe where you sit today, God has unearthed things that you've put your hope in, that's your rock, that's not the Lord. And you're coming to the table today to confess that, and to declare that Christ alone can satisfy you in a way that nothing else in this earth can. So that's my prayer for this. We're going to put Psalm 62, verses 5 through 7, up on the screen, as just to kind of be something that you can read as we go to these different places to be reminded of who Jesus is and what he's done with us and for us. If you've never been here at the Branch for the Lord's Supper, we believe that this is a symbol of Christ. So the bread represents his flesh that was wounded on our behalf, and the grape juice represents his blood that was shed for the forgiveness of sins. And so we have four tables. There's two in the back, there's two up front, and in just a minute I'm going to pray over the elements, and you and your family and the people around you, you're going to come to the table, and don't rush back to your seats. We want this to be worshipful, we want this to be reflective. We want this to be the room to be filled with prayers, engaging with Jesus in a fresh way. Sometimes we need to be reminded because we're too busy. So part of the heartbeat behind the Lord's Supper, at least according to the New Testament, is to chill a little bit, to slow down your pace and just be with the Lord. So we're going to do that. So I'm going to pray. You come and let's reflect on how Christ alone is our rock and our salvation. Dear God, I'm praying that your Spirit right now would move in the hearts of every single person that's here. And God, I know nobody in this room wants to come to the Lord's to your table today out of tradition or custom or just because that's we're a church and we do the Lord's Supper. Like, we want to come to follow what you say about it, which is we want to do this in remembrance of you, Lord. So I'm asking that your Spirit would use this time of taking the Lord's Supper to sanctify us, to purify us, to make us more holy, to conform us to your image, Lord Jesus. So, Lord, would you do that for your glory and your splendor so we